Well, I am not a member. I'm I teach in civil and environmental engineering at the University of Tennessee, so please don't hold that against me. I get accused of doing more science than engineering, which is fine with me as well. I enjoy hanging out with that side of the house. And I think Alice Layton was originally invited to come and give this talk. She's the one that's done most of our bacteroides work, and she wasn't able to make it. But we constitute a team, me doing more groundwater hydrology, and I tell you that so you'll understand where some of my bias comes from, and then Alice in the microbiology department, and Larry McKay, who is also a groundwater hydrologist. So I appreciate the talks that came before, Tom, Jody, and Kim. Good information there and a lot of ideas for me to take back to our folks. Unfortunately, I didn't link it to Katrina. All I can really tell you is that Katrina probably came up through out of the Gulf, and it did rain in Tennessee, but probably not on any one of these dates that we collected samples for. The purpose of our approach, just to sort of summarize this for you, it was really to use the watershed scale to evaluate the behavior characteristics of fecal bacterial loads, and I'll say other constituents, because we're also interested in other things that occur in sort of a time frequency pattern that will tell us a little bit more about what's happening in terms of a broad perspective of the behavior of the watershed. And really to take, and for example, calcium, perhaps chloride, perhaps nitrate, things like this that might represent different ecological interfaces in the watershed as well. But how these are leaked to land use and hydrologic fluxes was an important part of the questions that we were asking ourselves. Can we determine the sources and causation of the persistence that we see, at least at this watershed scale, and evaluate scaling of processes? Actually, I'm going to say that that's part of our future work. That will not be in part of the presentation today. But we do have a paper in review right now that hopefully I can comment a little bit on. And then evaluate the temporal frequency structure, if we can sort of develop a fingerprint for these watershed behavior characteristics. So just to give you a little bit of background, and a lot of what I'm going to present here came out of these three papers. One just came out in the last issue of JEQ, and that was looking at the efficacy of bacteroides for reducing sort of the statistical uncertainty associated with hydrologic flow and fecal loads. The one before that was last year, was more looking at E. coli loading at base flow characteristics within this watershed. And then the earlier paper was the paper that where Alice led the team looking at the development of actually the bacteroides 16S rRNA protocols for the assays, looking at both human and bovine fecal pollution. So, again, trying to describe this as looking at the watershed scale, watersheds act like filters, okay? We get random noise in and out of watersheds, and some of these are continuous, some of them are discontinuous. Some of them are hydrologic, some of them are more reaction-based. But watersheds take all of those different inputs and act sort of like a black box filter and produce a continuous time signal, hopefully. Except in the southeast, it's been somewhat discontinuous this year due to the greater than 100-year drought, but for the most part, continuous signal out of the watershed. And that continuous signal carries all of the information from those various random inputs into the watershed. So if you can find a way to decouple those, then you can learn a little bit more about the source inputs. And that's where we're headed. What I'll describe to you today is part of what we were looking at was trying to take some basic initial observational steps to try and determine what the statistical or probabilistic behavior in these watersheds, what it really looked like. And again, with most of these things, we could develop a synthetic watershed, right? We know enough now that we can take constitutive models and try and play games with what likely is happening in the watershed. But the problem is the processes that we are not capturing that way, right? And overlumping of parameters and not really linking that back to processes occurring in the watershed. So our case study that I'm going to talk a little bit about today is the Stock Creek watershed. It's a relatively small watershed that exists at sort of the urban ag fringe in and near the city of Knoxville. What made this sort of a neat case study is we had a local watershed group that was interested in having folks at the university work with them to try and find out some practical solutions to what was happening with their water quality, especially with some of those streams being placed on the 303D list. So the state put some money forward through its TMDL program and 319 funding, which is administered in Tennessee by the Tennessee Department of Ag, to take a look at this watershed and if we could offer some advice about what the sources and causation for the persistence might be and what approaches they may use to implement some best management practices and get their streams off the 303D list. It's located here in East Tennessee. You can tell probably this is a black and white version of a blue line map for most of the streams in this area. As you can probably already tell, it's in a ridge and valley province, so all the streams are shoved up against one fairly high elevation ridge and tend to run in a fairly straight line direction anyway. Our area of study with Stock Creek was this little small basin right here, which I'll show in a little bit more detail. This is that basin that I showed you. This is a digital elevation model just to give you an idea of the relief throughout this basin. Again, the stream starts here in the headwaters, SE7. We've denoted it, again, we didn't have a very creative way to number these basins either, so it's just SE1 through 7. I wish I could say that it was something creative. You know, I've often thought, you know, the NSF and NEON, and they're going to naming these things after Greek gods or something, that we should start doing that with sampling points, but that would probably be going overboard a bit. So each one of these dots here represents a sample location. We actually did do some work here at SC1, but it represented embayment conditions, and I will not include those because the results really couldn't be interpreted adequately. And I'm now experiencing what you experienced, the mouse disappearing on me here. I might just keep it going in a little circle here as I'm talking. So anyway, it starts here in the headwaters, show where some of the tributaries come in and then flows out to this area. And I don't think there's really anything there more to describe. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the hydrology within the basin as well, just to give you an idea. This is a storm that came through. You know, people think doing hydrologic research would be easy, but we suffer from the same things that everybody else does. You can't go out, you can't sample everywhere, you can't go collect data intensely throughout even a small watershed with some level of accuracy unless you have an incredible amount of money, right? It's always linked to the amount that somebody's willing to pay for this. And this was a very low funding in terms of what we were able to accomplish in this study. And so I had my graduate student go out and throw some piezometers that we typically use for groundwater studies. These are not actual stage gauge stations, but we put some piezometers in and just captured some relative heads moving through the system from a couple of different storm events. And I guess what I'm trying to show here is just from the headwaters down, you see some fairly sharp, flashy reactions in a couple of these sub-basins, but as we move down past SE4, we really start to have the trailing recession limbs, which would indicate more storage and water being backed up in the system. And just using that to get some idea of what the relative time of concentrations between these systems might be. And the main purpose also for showing this is that we collected all of our samples during base flow. We didn't do any storm event sampling. Our primary interest was to make sure that we were at least what we would consider a near base flow condition, which means we didn't sample until at least 24 hours after after an event. The circles I typically use on this slide are gone, so let me just show you what I was trying to show here. One of the questions that we have, even at the base flow conditions, this represents one area in the watershed, and we do have sinkholes in this area. It's not as karstic as the cave you showed in Kentucky, but there are quite a few caves and karstic features in this area, particularly in this small watershed. So the concern here is not only runoff, but runoff into sinkholes, storage within that system, and subsequent release. And, you know, as a groundwater hydrologist, often we're concerned about the conditions under which a tracer is applied and whether that experiment can be repeated. In this case, we don't worry about it so much. There tends to be a lot of tracer being applied throughout the watershed. Sometimes it's as simple as getting them out of the creek. But in this watershed, and I guess the thing I wanted to point out here too, I mentioned to you that this is sort of at the fringe, the urban ag fringe. This is a street that you could be driving along and there are cows in the creek, a nice little paddock there, and then you're immediately into sort of this rural subdivision type area. So sort of a gentleman farmer kind of scenario, I guess, where they keep the pet cows out in and around the watershed. So three different things in terms of our methodology, our approach to do this analysis. We primarily, at this point with the data, looking at both the E. coli and the bacterioides, we wanted to use just a statistical analysis looking at multivariate comparisons, both at a global scale and a local scale. Global meaning all the data together, local meaning what can we say about changes between monitoring points throughout the watershed. And we're looking at bivariate correlations, and with the bacterioides, the paper that just came out, we did a little bit of k-means cluster analysis to try and indicate sort of what processes might be occurring hydrologically. For the bacterioides quantification, I think it's already been talked about here. We used real-time PCR on water samples without DNA extraction, just water straight in. Human, cattle, and equine bacterioides were used to develop an assay that we called ALBAC. Bovine bacterioides, BOBAC, and human bacterioides, HUBAC. All of these were extremely sensitive in that they were able to detect 100% the presence if there, but we did notice, similar to what was mentioned before with human or HUBAC assay, that there was a 30% chance of being misidentified with swine. And then our E. coli quantification, it was actually, the analysis was done by the state of Tennessee and they used a CoAlert sample analysis technique. So this is what I was talking about when I mentioned the global data set. These are all the samples that we collected and we just lumped them together. And we just wanted to find out, just from intuitively you may have some idea of what you would think these relationships would be, but it's helpful often to go back and take a look at these. So these are scatter plots, primarily shown on the bottom left half of this matrix. On the upper right part of the matrix is a correlation coefficient, the covariance of the two variables divided by the standard deviation of each individual distribution. And along the diagonal, we have antecedent, 7-day antecedent precipitation flow in the stream, E. coli load, turbidity, temperature, pH, and conductivity. And the idea here was just to say, well, what was highly correlated, what was not at a global scale? Now, another reason for doing this is to ask yourself the question, at what scale or what level should I be monitoring? Do I just want to go to the end of the watershed, grab a sample where everything's being ejected? Or do I want to do some sort of synoptic model monitoring throughout the watershed? What's most important here to capture some of the behavioral attributes? And we found out that E. coli load was highly correlated with turbidity. And then if we go up this way, very little correlation, at least at the global scale, nothing that we can really get excited about with antecedent precipitation. And I don't think there's really anything else that's necessary to point out there. Again, this was sort of a filtering technique to find out what was most important. And just to give you an idea, on those black lines on the scatter plots represent a 95% density ellipse. So that's what encapsulates about 95% of the data. If you see a rounded ellipse, it's a fairly poor fit, or poor correlation rather. And if you see something more on the sort of elongated pattern, then that's a fairly good correlation, or better correlation relatively. Now at the local level, what we would do is we would take each individual point and then we would say, well, what's happening at each one of the individual monitoring points? And again, this is going from headwaters to discharge at the bottom, and we find with the E. coli load, we find very high correlations between antecedent precipitation in the headwaters, but much lower in the lower part of the watershed, particularly down in this SC3, SC4 area. And again, we think that that's really probably because of the storage within the system. As you saw, those recession limbs lasted for a pretty good long time on that hydrograph, and so water is being backed up and stored within that system. And then the same issue here actually is that in the headwaters, we have very low correlation between turbidity and antecedent precipitation, some with turbidity, but that really increases in the bottom part of the watershed. So the E. coli loads really highly correlated to turbidity, possible sediment in the bottom part of the watershed, less so in the headwaters, and much more highly correlated with antecedent precipitation in the headwaters, and much less so because of probable storage mechanisms in the bottom part of the watershed. So this is the bacterioides data. The second paper followed up and said, okay, well, let's take a look at some of this data with respect to our BOBAC and ALLBAC. And we found a fairly good correlation between BOBAC, ALLBAC, turbidity, E. coli loads, less so with antecedent precipitation. I'm sorry, this is ALLBAC. And then BOBAC actually had fairly high correlations relative to antecedent precipitation and probably about the same correlation with E. coli load. And again, not to overdo it too much here, but then looking at each individual location and going back and demonstrating where BOBAC tended to correlate well with ALLBAC and turbidity, and seeing very similar patterns to what we saw in the earlier chart. Again, somewhat of a discrimination between headwater parts of the reach and the lower portions of the watershed. So at that point, what I wanted to do, and again, I mentioned that using those scatter plots and those correlations can sort of help you identify, well, what are my most important parameters that I'd like to look at? So in this case, we wanted to do some k-means clustering, and what that involves is taking the parameters that you find most important. You take multidimensional data and you convert it into a single vector, in this case a principal component. And here we have two principal components which captured most of the variability in the data. And we take and we plot all of the individual data according to those two principal components, and we look for patterns that emerge in the data. Many times they don't. Okay, so this is not a technique that always works. You wind up with one principal component that captures 99% of the variability, and other principal components less than 1%. So you don't. There is no pattern. It's a straight line. So in this case, what we did is we went in and we looked at E. coli, ALLBAC, and BOBAC with this clustering approach, and we identified three primary clusters in each one, and I apologize, the numbers are slightly different in these if you try and rationalize what's going on with 1, 2, and 3 in each one of these. But what we found is that this cluster in this area tends to be a mixture of waters that are probably stormwater and groundwater related, and we saw in the other two clusters, ones that tend to be related to higher loadings, lower turbidity, high loadings, high turbidity. And so what emerged out of that was sort of a conceptual model on the basis of these cluster analyses that we probably have something that's a mixture of sources for the persistence issue. Remember, these are base flow. This is after the storm event, after things have moved along. And we probably have in this area, which would represent a higher turbidity, higher bacteria concentrations, loads, a runoff-dominated transport and persistence, whereas over here we have lower turbidity, but yet we still have a persistent high loading, which probably represents a groundwater-dominated transport and persistence. This seemed reasonable to me following up on some of the literature that exists. I don't know if many folks have seen the Dussart Baptista paper in Journal of Hydrology, but looking at the attached versus non-attached bacteria, particularly in these karst systems, where you can have persistent bacteria, low turbidity, being driven out of the system from groundwater influences. And we think this is a likely cause within this system for that persistence at base flow. Now the question becomes, this is a good way to filter that and identify an initial conceptual model. We now need to go back and test this hypothesis as well. The problem as I'm sure you know, as you start working at the watershed scale, there are very few research watersheds out there. I think USDA probably has the best opportunity there. But we have to deal with landowners and access and those kind of things. So we can't go in and sample the springs. And that was one of the reasons for doing this is synoptic monitoring and trying to make some inferences about the integrated samples in the stream. But we should go back and collect samples just to validate this conceptual model. Just in summary, I think we can say that coupled hydrologic and these bacterial source tracking studies can be used together to better understand watershed land use dynamics. I should state our group, we've talked about this, we are not strong advocates for using only one technique. I would not have been here, nobody else would have been here preaching to you that bacterioides was a solution for anything. We think it's another tool, and probably the best use of in these types of studies is to use as many tools as you have together, because you have competing problems with all of these different tools. In some cases where you have inhibition, depending upon what sort of situation you're in, it may be that another tool works better than bacterioides with real-time PCR. But it does provide an additional tool for quantifying fecal loads, which is what we were not able to do before, prior to this study in our case. So these new tools may also aid in longer-term monitoring and determination of BMP effectiveness. So if we can go back in areas and we know what the historical loading patterns for BOBAC and ALBAC were, then we can go back after the implementation of BMPs and take a look at the loading behavior after that. Now, I argue that that's not simply going out and taking a few measurements, that actually what we really need to decide upon is the type of monitoring protocol that we need to have. And if we're going to be looking at a time frequency type of structure, what's adequate? And if you talk to someone in the research field, it's going to be something at the week interval. And if you talk to someone who's willing to pay for it, they're going to want you to do it maybe monthly, and maybe that's too often for them. But I think that's going to be important as we start looking at effectiveness. So thank you. Well, let me back up. Perhaps I said something too strongly. The storm events are important. We were using the base flow events to characterize something about the system and the persistence. So I think something, probably a combination of base flow storm event, is going to be needed. I think the base flow is important because most people are not going to be out. If you're doing it from a human health, public health perspective, most people are not going to be out in the stream in a storm event. In this particular area, but they will be out at base flow. We're the only ones that will probably be out in a storm event collecting samples. Most of them would not be. Now, the storm events also are responsible for distributing a lot of that bacteria and other things in the floodplain. So I do think the storm event sampling is important, but I think there's been an incredible amount of focus in that area, and now we need to also think about base flow characteristics as well. Tom? Well, I just went from the date that we were going to sample, I went back and took a cumulative summary of the previous 7 days leading up to that event. But for the 24 hours prior to that sampling event, we knew there was no rainfall. But we wanted to know something about the extended period. Was there a low frequency, high volume event that preceded that drier period?
For the clustering at the end?
Really, you know, we left Hubeck out of it, to be honest. We really focused on Boback and Allback. And the reason for that was that Hubeck wasn't as dependable in this watershed because of the cross influences with swine. Were there differences between Boback and Allback? They were fairly similar, but we did start to see some differences at behavior at the sub-watershed level. But the main story being what we still saw as being activated in the upper part of the watershed, and then what was being stored at the bottom part of the watershed was fairly consistent. Yeah, it's hydrologic storage principally, but I suppose I was being a bit vague there. There's a lot of sediment hanging around in the bottom part of the watershed as well. Now, whether you can infer that that may be responsible for some of that persistence due to attachment, survival, and enhancement of that, I think is for a next stage study. But I think that's an important connection. So there's hydrologic storage, slower drainage in that part, and it's allowed the accumulation of sediment as well in those reaches. And I think that's probably an important part of the story. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.